One may say perhaps that the original Tibetan contribution to Tibetan Buddhist art is represented principally by two things. One is Tibetan religious architecture. For instance, there is the very well-known, the wonderful example of the Potala, the palace or the monastery or temple, it's all three combined, of the Dalai Lama at Lhasa. This was originally, of course, a secular building. It was originally a sort of castle of the kings of Tibet, but it was transformed by the great fifth Dalai Lama and his prime minister into something much more characteristically, much more definitely Tibetan, the sort of thing which we all know, which we're all familiar with from photographs and pictures. The style of architecture which one finds in Tibet was, of course, determined to a very great extent by climatic conditions. Tibet's a very, very cold place. It's a place of terrific winds and so on. So one needs protection from these things. And at the same time, the nature of the Tibetan religious architecture was determined, or is determined, by the nature of the materials available. It's probably not generally realized that in Tibet, whereas one has plenty of stone and plenty of rock for building purposes, one has very, very little wood indeed. The greater part of Tibet is completely non-forested. One just has a few bushes, a few shrubs, but very, very few trees. So wood is not used generally for building purposes. It's not used for fuel. For fuel, they usually burn cakes made of yak's dung. So this factor also plays its part, the fact that stone is available in vast quantities, but hardly any wood. So one sees these two facts contributing to determine some of the most distinctive features of the Tibetan religious architecture. To begin with, you find enormously thick walls. Some of the walls, I'm told, are 10 and 12 and 15 feet thick, like the thickest of our castle walls in Europe. And this is to keep out the cold and to keep out the frost and the damp. And at the same time, the lines are usually very, very simple. The Tibetans are rather fond of vertical lines which slope slightly inwards. And they're also fond of flat roofs. And this is a sort of basic pattern, the basic scheme. And when one gets these most characteristic of all religious buildings, the monasteries or gompas, and when one finds them built up in the mountains, sometimes on crags and spurs of rock, when one sees them rising out of the rock, rising out of the mountain, it's just as though the gompa, the monastery, is a sort of natural growth of the mountain. It's as though it had grown straight up out of the living rock. You can't see really where the mountain ends and where the monastery begins. This is true of the Potala, perhaps above all, but it's also true of practically all the monasteries and temples and gompas generally in Tibet. They seem to be, at least from a distance, continuations of the mountains themselves. And this particular feature, this particular characteristic of Tibetan religious architecture is brought out very well in a number of paintings by Lama Anagarika Govinda. I'm sure most of you have heard his name. Many of you I know have read either his Foundations of Tibetan Mysticism or his Way of the White Clouds. He's well known as a writer, but not so many people are aware of the fact that Lama Govinda is not only a very great writer on Buddhism, but also a very great Buddhist artist. And inasmuch as he has sojourned for quite a while in Tibet and been fascinated by the Tibetan scene generally, quite a number of his paintings, which are usually in pastels, depict these magnificent, rather barren, rocky Tibetan landscapes with these magnificent monasteries or gompas at heights many, many thousands of feet above sea level, growing, as it were, out of the living rock of the mountains. And this fact, as he has represented, as he has depicted, it seems to possess a very deep symbolical significance of its own. It isn't as though religion, the religious life, the monastic life, is sort of stuck onto the secular life, so that you can see where the two join. You can see the crack, as it were. It isn't like that. It's as though the one grows up quite naturally out of the other, as a sort of culmination and perfection of the other. And looking at these paintings of Lama Govinda, showing these mountains, showing the Gompas on them, one gets this sort of feeling, this sort of impression, very, very strongly indeed. One can see the same sort of thing if one looks not just at paintings of this kind, but even at ordinary photographs taken by travellers and visitors of the great monastic shrines of Tibet. One can see the way in which their lines continue the lines of the mountains, so that, as I said, the buildings seem to grow out of the rock itself. So this, we may say, is the first original indigenous Tibetan contribution to Tibetan Buddhist art. The religious, especially the monastic architecture. This is specifically Tibetan. This owes nothing to India. This owes nothing to China. And secondly, as the second indigenous Tibetan contribution, we may mention the remarkable colour sense of the Tibetans. That remarkable awareness of and sensitivity to colour, especially as shown, especially as represented by the Tanka paintings, the Tibetan painted scrolls. In the course of the first lecture, when I was speaking about Tibet generally, about the general conditions that prevail there, I mentioned the remarkable clarity of the atmosphere. Apparently when you get 12,000 feet above sea level, as you do when you go to Tibet, when you emerge through the passes which lead from India into Tibet, when you're at this height of 12,000 feet or more above sea level, you rise, as it were, not only above the mountains, not only above the clouds, but above all the impurities which we usually encounter in the atmosphere. You rise above, of course, fog and smoke and smog and smudge and things of this sort, and you find yourself, perhaps for the first time in your life, in a completely clear, a completely crystalline atmosphere. And to your astonishment, you can see scores, perhaps even hundreds of miles, if you are high enough up. It's so clear, and it's so transparent. And Lama Govinda has described this too very, very beautifully and very, very powerfully in his book, The Way of the White Clouds. So when everything is so clear, when everything is so transparent, so translucent, so sparkling, if you like, when, as I said in the earlier lecture, the sky is really blue. In this country, we never see a blue sky. You may think that you see a blue sky, but what you see is not really blue. It's a sort of muddy, impure colour. It's sort of clouded over because you're looking up at the blue sky through a sort of mist, through a sort of fog. And you don't usually become aware of this because one is so accustomed to it that we just take it for granted that the sky is like that. But if you get up into the heights of Tibet, if you get above this sort of level of human-created smog and dirt and dust, then you see the sky as it really appears, or perhaps I shouldn't say as it really appears, but as it more nearly appears when you get to this altitude, and you see how blue it really is. So the Tibetans see colours like this. They see a blue sky, which is blue. When they look at the red rocks are red. And I remember Lama Govinda himself telling me with what a sort of shock of astonishment it was that when he opened his eyes in Tibet on a clear, bright morning, he saw rocks all around him, mountains all around him, which were so red, so richly and brilliantly and powerfully and livingly red, that he was just taken aback. He just couldn't believe his eyes. He thought it was some sort of hallucination. But Tibet is like that. When you look at the waters of a lake, they're a deep, a rich, a vivid turquoise. When you look at the thousands of miles of landscape, it's a deep, rich brown, merging into a beautiful purple. So all around you see wonderful colours, translucent and iridescent and very, very brilliant and sparkling colours. So the Tibetans have a wonderfully developed colour sense. And the art of the Tibetans, the religious art of the Tibetans, especially the Tankas, especially the painted scrolls, they reflect this. The best of them, painted in the complete Orthodox tradition, employ only organic and mineral pigments. If there are any artists present, I think there are quite a few today, this may be of some little interest to them, that Tibetan Tangka painters traditionally do not use any prepared colours. They get earth and they get vegetable products and they get semi-precious stones and they grind them themselves according to traditional techniques. And they mix them with oil and so on, and they use them in this way. They don't buy them ready-made. Though I'm sorry to say, that some who've come into contact with Western civilization are beginning to do this now. But the old artists, the traditional ones, they still employ these natural colors. And this helps them to get these really brilliant and really jewel-like effects. Now, some of the tankas which I've seen in and around Kalimpong, belonging to Tibetan friends, and in Tibetan Buddhist monasteries and temples, are really remarkable for this fact, the sheer brilliance, the dazzling brilliance, one may say, of the colouring. At the same time, there's nothing loud, huh? There's nothing, as it were, harsh, that nothing that sort of shrieks at you. Huh? It's a brilliance, but it's a sort of soft, a gentle brilliance. It isn't anything which seems unnatural. One can accept it. It seems real. Huh? And the fact that the tankas, the painted scrolls, are so brilliantly and vividly coloured has its own connection with the purpose for which the tanka itself is intended, as we shall see a little later on.